This is side two of session 13, August 15, 2006. And we're continuing a quote from LaRouche, the essay written in 1978, The Secrets Known Only to the Inner Elites. And Scott got a paragraph cut off in the middle, so we'll just go back to the beginning of that paragraph. And then there's one more paragraph after that in this section, in this quote.
Such hypotheses are defined by Riemann as, quote, unique hypotheses. Their distinction, in effect, is that they test laws of the universe for a category of knowledge, rather than merely testing the applicability of extension of established principles to a problem without involving a testing of general laws. Such hypotheses are more commonly, less rigorously termed, quote, crucial experimental hypotheses. In the case such a hypothesis fails experimentally, no loss. The failure of the hypothesis narrows qualitatively our approach to the axiomatic facility it attacked.
The axiomatic fallacy
it attacked. And thus acts as a positive progress in knowledge for attacking the axiomatic fallacy in a more effective way.
Great. So if you look at this whole quote, he's saying, now he's describing how the process of reason works. And it's basically saying, you look at the scientific knowledge around you and you question it. The Platonic method is, on a cliche level, known as Socrates questioning everybody around him, right?
Mm-hmm.
Pushing the process of questioning to some intensity. So he's saying that. If you read this with that in mind, you'll see it's not hard to understand. He's saying that there may be principles in the universe that do not vary. And he calls them the transinvariant. They don't vary over a stretch of time or across a period of experience, or trans. Yeah, trans means across, right? So, again, okay, I'm going to read this with that in mind and stop here and there. Again, the only aspect of human consciousness which is in correspondence with such a transfinite or transinvariant principle of the universe is the quality of progress in human scientific knowledge rather than any specific subsumed scientific knowledge as such. So the only aspect of human consciousness which is in that doesn't vary, that's almost a principle, is the fact that new knowledge progresses and subsumes older knowledge. In other words, that things change.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only thing that's constant. Progressive change.
Mm-hmm.
See, the principle is, yeah, the quality of progress, the quality of progress, rather than a specific particular knowledge. So he's saying how fast you progress is the real important point,
mm-hmm,
not what you know.
Right.
So you know this, you get stuck in it and go around celebrating what you know. You miss the point. The idea is to speed up the rate of new knowledge discovered. So he says, the adducing of that principle in turn provides the methodological principle for ordering thought to the effect of willfully energizing the progress of scientific knowledge. Keep pushing forward. That is the method of rigorous hypothesis. That is the meaning of the dialectical method, the method of rigorously developing valid hypotheses. And you do that by questioning whatever you know. It's so much that you realize that what you know is limited, then you got to look for something else.
You probably got to take new knowledge and sort of stabilize it for a while before you can move on to,
right,
changing, mutating that into by newer knowledge. So
the Aristotelian stops at what the second level, mere understanding, and categorizes and fetishizes what you know.
Yeah. And LaRouche, being an economist, must understand that, of course, people's livelihoods depend on having, you know, their knowledge be the last word. And so I've heard that it's the young guys, the 20-year-olds that make the brilliant breakthroughs in physics. Those tend to be their most productive years. And then they tend to, I think, settle into the beliefs that the new knowledge or the new beliefs that they discovered while they were young, because they make a career out of it. They don't want somebody to come along and upset their new knowledge.
Right, and in the 18th, 19th century, as Western man specialized and built on a specialty, people into an economy. Now, LaRouche said, well, that economy is run by the usurious oligarchs who forced everybody to get stuck, and they couldn't, if they developed any new knowledge, the oligarchs wouldn't let them because they wanted to capitalize on what they had and keep it, and make sure the effects don't smarten, enliven people. So there's a political aspect of suppression here, and that's one thing to remember, that if you're moving forward, if you've got a benevolent oligarchy or benevolent rulers, an elite that is not satisfied in just consolidating, getting comfortable with what you know.
Yeah.
And so people were forced to specialize and fetishize details and hang on to what they'd established when they were young because there was nowhere to go any further because the larger oligarchy forces weren't going to let you progress that rapidly.
Yeah.
So specialization is defined as a cultural bias due to the printing press from McLuhan's point of view, and specialization and getting bogged down in categories is a product of oligarchic evil rulers, in LaRouche's point. This is what we call a top-down view of the cause of lack of progress, right?
And it may become a conspiracy in which the masses participate, because if you try to change the economy too rapidly, that affects everybody's job, right down to the guy who shoes horses.
Right, so you gotta educate the people early to get ready for change.
Yeah, which is, well, kind of how we live today.
Yeah,
you've got to be ready for change today.
Yeah, and a change many people perceive as going down in terms of wages.
Right.
So McLuhan's talking about a bottom-up level of mythological creation, and LaRouche is talking a top-down form of mythological creation.
Yeah, and they both use the term mythology differently.
Yes.
I think LaRouche, McLuhan would say that the mythology in the sense that he uses it is fictional.
No, they both are similar. I would say that what's different when I said, yes, they're different, is McLuhan is looking at the sensory structure in an environment, the given, the cultural understanding and technology is shaping bias, and that's a mythology. Whereas LaRouche is talking about more mental concepts,
right,
as mythologies.
Exactly. So,
right, it's like he's thinking in the ineffable thought zone, and LaRouche and McLuhan is looking at the sensory structure.
Right.
And so, on that simple level, LaRouche is Platonic, and McLuhan is Aristotelian.
Right.
But McLuhan is a critic of the Aristotelian limitations, but he uses their method to undermine them. In other words, he emphasizes the senses.
Yeah.
And it's concomitant, environmentally induced mythology, sensory mythologies. So back to LaRouche, he says, he's trying to describe, now we're going to talk about the method. So the method is, it sounds like he's going to break down the assumptions of people around him. And he says that in the next paragraph. He says, the method employed is the Platonic method of negation of Talcide, as applied from the standpoint of the level of reason. You're not just being a naysayer. You have a purpose in cutting down and looking for assumptions that aren't helping. The method of negation means to isolate those axiomatic fallacies of existing knowledge, understanding or categories, which bear upon crucial experimental problems confronting us. And he uses the term crucial experimental later as a less rigorous term for major developments. So you take crucial experimental problems confronting you, and you really look at what is hiding the facts or the way to go forward with the problem. You're not resting on the assumptions. The qualitative elimination of the axiomatic fallacy permits the defining of experiments, which can be represented in terms of quantitative relationships. In other words, you're moving towards making experiments that can be statistically useful, or that prove something along the statistical means, right? Or via statistical means.
Mm-hmm.
The essential underlying test of the validity of an hypothesis as an hypothesis posed in this way is the test of whether the hypothesis, if successfully demonstrated, implies a means for increasing the negentropy of human practice. Negentropy means getting more efficient technology and better technology. So the way to test the validity of a hypothesis is that, is it a means, questioning and checking to see if it's a means to getting better hypotheses and better technologies.
Technology translating into goods and services, so more efficient production and more efficient the production of goods and services.
Yeah. Such hypotheses are defined by Riemann, who lived 1830s, 40s, and 50s, and 60s. Riemann is a big breakthrough in the Platonic thread, the Platonic team. Bernard Riemann is a very important person in LaRouche's pantheon of intellectual gods. And Riemann was and Riemann is known as the guy who inspired Einstein.
Oh, what period did he live?
What theory did he live?
Yeah, Riemann.
He developed non-Euclidean geometry.
Okay.
And Euclid is a bad Aristotelian dupe and anti-Platonic. So Riemann made some big breakthroughs, including moving away from Euclidean geometry.
And when did he do that?
1854 is one of his famous essays. Time of the Crimean War, which is a key figure in thinning his wake. The Crimean War, when the telegraph is in, it's the first global civil war.
Oh.
First Vietnam, telegraph broadcasting what was going on in the Crimea.
Oh, yeah.
And Florence Nightingale came out of that, the nursing profession.
Mm-hmm. And okay. What's LaRouche's criticism of Euclid?
Euclid is developing geometry based on the line, and not in developing theorems that you memorize, and those theorems become assumptions that block progress. Whereas the other way, the Platonic geometry, working with the five solids, always teaches students to learn how to make the solids and not build from assumptions or theorems.
Ah.
We should see that later in some of the quotes here.
Yeah. Very good.
So, beg your pardon?
Very good.
Yeah, if you look at Krishnamurti and the way he would deny what everybody knew, you know, he'd play and get rid of your assumptions, it's like LaRouche is like seeing Plato as a Krishnamurti, but very active politically. LaRouche Krishnamurti didn't believe in political action. But LaRouche is applying this kind of erasing of the assumptions around you and claiming it's a political act.
Mm-hmm.
Just an interesting parallel. Okay, so such hypotheses are defined by Riemann as unique hypotheses, in quotes. Their distinction, now it's in quotes, I guess, because if hypotheses are actually following the laws of reason, they aren't unique, but they appear to be unique, and they are crucially experimental hypotheses. Their distinction, in effect, is that they test the laws of the universe for a category of knowledge, rather than merely testing the applicability of extension of established principles to a problem without involving a testing of general laws. So he's saying the Aristotelian wrong method is you take established principles and apply them without checking to see if they follow and are resonant with general laws, which are always subject to testing.
Well, in a sense, that's what an engineer does, but that's his job. But then you have the theoretical physicist who's coming up with new things, playing around with new things that maybe the engineer will be able to implement in the future.
Yeah, and LaRouche seems to favor the engineers. They used to be called, in the 70s by journalists, a cult for engineers.
Mm.
And he wasn't into speculative theoretical stuff. He doesn't have much respect for many of the famous physicists of the last 100 years.
Oh, yeah. But that's a contradiction, because the engineer just takes established principles and engineers them into buildings and cars and electronics. And
yeah, but the engineer, that's the engineer under oligarchic conditions. LaRouche said, let's open up the engineering profession and make them political and make them really understand and open to new developments and not get stuck in their category.
Yeah, and they're not an ivory tower. They're the hands-on guys.
Yeah, and they're important, but they're not getting a comprehensive education.
Yeah.
They're just sitting in their jobs, where he'd have them out there getting pushing and developing and trying to get rid of their assumptions and develop new technologies and looking for people who could do it.
Yeah.
So such hypotheses are defined, reading that again, such hypotheses are defined by Riemann as unique hypotheses. Their distinction in the effect of them is that they test the laws of the universe for a category of knowledge, rather than merely testing the applicability of extension of established principles to a problem without involving testing of general laws. So LaRouche is asking for, like a philosopher or someone who looks at the big picture. LaRouche is saying we must always test the big picture, rather than looking at what we think we know and working within it.
Mm-hmm.
Such hypotheses are more commonly, less rigorously termed, crucial experimental hypotheses. So I guess the crucial experimental hypotheses are the big picture hypotheses. Oh, wait a minute. No, he's saying these hypotheses are more commonly, less rigorously termed, crucial experimental hypotheses. These are hypotheses that are testing the laws of the universe rather than working with established principles that don't involve a testing of general laws. In the case such an hypothesis fails experimentally, no loss. The failure of the hypothesis narrows qualitatively our approach to the axiomatic fallacy it attacked, and thus acts as positive progress in knowledge for attacking that axiomatic fallacy in a more effective way. So he's saying, if our crucial experiment hypothesis doesn't work, then we can know that, well, we can go this way. We now know not to go that way.
Mm-hmm.
All the time, using the method of Platonic method of negation to getting at the universal principles and not resting on our laurels.
Right.
Now, let's go into, I think that's pretty obvious what he's saying, whether it's real or acceptable is another point, but we're going to go further on as he develops this.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you a question before we do that. This is maybe difficult to communicate but I'm pretty clear now about how the Euclidean axioms and theorems become sort of fixed frameworks to work within, and they don't allow for new insights and developments. But how does playing with the five Platonic solids lead to creative insight? What about those five Platonic solids make them so magical that they become, devices for invoking new insights?
Okay, here's the answer to that. Euclidean geometry develops from the line, but Platonic geometry develops from the circle. You create a circle, you fold half the circle over the other side, and you have a line.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
A curved line.
No, in the middle. Make it
half. In the middle, yeah, gotcha.
And that's how, in other words, you don't join two points. You always take the same form of the circle and work with the circle and fold it over in different patterns.
Oh, okay.
And the five Platonic solids unfold when you do that.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, you have to get, when you were in the LaRouche organization for a while, you never had a chance to get those courses. They weren't teaching them too much, but every now and then they'll teach them. But if you read their literature, they spell it. But it's better to have someone show you. And it's very interesting how they show what's it's called synthetic geometry is another term for it.
I guess you'd have to start with a sphere because the solids are dimensional, at least three-dimensional, and the circle is just flat plane with,
circle. Right, they say the circle is the self-evident thing they work with, and that to get the next forms by folding over the circle, you're not making up assumptions. You're just following the law of the unfoldment.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, this requires an expert to go into and explain this, and we're not going to spend time doing that.
Right.
Look up some LaRouche literature, and you'll find every now and then they give you samples. They used to do this in their newspaper. I still have samples left over. They'd run a series for several issues of New Solidarity and have the course and show all the pictures and how you fold the circles over, and they'd give you this whole geometry course. And apparently there was a guy named Klein, 200 years ago. He was one of the last advocates of this synthetic non-Euclidean geometry. There's Euclidean geometry, and then there's the antidote by Riemann, non-Euclidean.
Hmm.
That was still within the, we'll call it the Aristotelian form of knowledge. The synthetic form of geometry, which is, we'll call it anti-Euclidean rather than non-Euclidean, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Anti-Euclidean was a whole stream that was deleted from the curriculum like 150 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a big loss. Because basically the kids would all, and when you did it, you would learn how things unfolded by doing, rather than memorizing theorems, which is just memorizing categories and principles and assumptions.
Right.
And that dulls the brain.
Sure. Yeah. It's not involving like doing the, folding the circle and stuff and seeing how it works and involving yourself in the process.
Right, and as LaRouche would say, the five Platonic solids were not icons in themselves to be worshipped.
Yeah.
They were unfolding patterns that pointed to more patterns,
right.
But you always got them when you first learned how to do it.
Yeah, and there's a tactility involved. You're using your hands to fold this thing and to create space, and it involves more. It involves more of the senses. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, what's the deal with the squaring of the circle? Was LaRouche obsessed with that? That's something that I hear about in occult circles. You know, the squaring of the circle is some magical thing that they've been trying to figure out. I don't know what any of that means, but is that something that he was concerned with?
Yeah, that was one of the paradoxes of the geometers, you know, time of Greece and Athens, is that they couldn't square the circle. And the solution from the Platonic point of view is very interesting, and they don't get trapped in the conundrum. And it's a paradox, but don't get trapped in it. Whereas the Euclidean and the Aristotelian, they would say couldn't be done and would remain stuck with the visible forms of it and think it was a mystery, and then that will lead into mystical babble.
What is the concept? I mean, a circle is a circle and a square is a square, so how do you square? If you square a circle, doesn't it become a square?
Well, no, you get these little, you get these more minute little points of the folding over process, and then making these little triangles, you fill in the edge of the circle more and more.
Oh, I see.
It's like trying to measure using, if I got it right, if I remember, I'm going to look at this for a long time. If you're you can't lineate the circle's edge.
Mm-hmm.
So you do it by folding triangles into it.
Mm. Oh, okay. Interesting.
It's like trying to make opposites cohere,
mm-hmm.
opposite forms,
mm-hmm.
even though LaRouche's solution to that is pretty interesting because it's the process rather than getting stuck at some point of final completion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, because I think Bucky Fuller said there are no perfect spheres in nature.
Yeah.
Did LaRouche like Bucky?
In one of the interviews Bob Marshall did with them back in 89, they go into Bucky Fuller, and LaRouche respected Fuller, but he thought that he didn't go all the way. And other people, the more pugnacious journalists in this organization, consider Bucky Fuller an agent of the oligarchs.
Oh.
So LaRouche, in his statement, is a little more diplomatic.
Yeah. I think you got to be cynical to consider Bucky to be an agent of the oligarchs.
Well, not if you look at the whole stuff that LaRouche lays out. McLuhan was used by the Venetian oligarchs, too, and Bucky Fuller. They all fit into the 60s counterculture. They promoted and created a hypnotic effect of they were like the thinkers within the Malthusian Aquarian model.
Yeah, from a paranoid LaRouchean perspective, but you wouldn't believe that.
Well, I don't mind exploring paranoia. I believe it to the extent I got to be paranoid, but I don't stay stuck in paranoia.
But there's no evidence connecting.
Oh yeah, you know our friend Mark Stallman, he researched the guy who worked with Bucky Fuller and created the huge text Synergy. You ever seen Synergy?
Heard of it?
Yeah, it's a collection of Bucky's work. Came out in the middle '70s. Well, the guy that worked with Bucky for decades was a CIA man.
Oh.
I forget his name. I think it was Applethwaite.
Yeah.
I could look it up, and he was ostensibly a guy who got a little alienated in the CIA bureaucracy and dropped out and joined Bucky, but that's what they do.
Yeah, but we don't know if he joined Bucky. He was, the CIA was eavesdropping on Bucky to see if they could learn from him, or if they were trying to contaminate him to their purposes.
Yeah, they were maybe doing something. Now, there's an obituary of the guy. When he died, they described him. When I read it, his profile totally fit the Aristotelian category lover.
Oh.
He's totally the non-Platonic, as LaRouche defines the difference between Platonists and Aristotelian. Very interesting.
Huh.
He was like an aesthete, a gadfly. And he liked wacky people like Bucky Fuller, and he hung out with Bucky Fuller.
But Bucky could think on his own 2 feet. I don't think he would be influenced by an inferior, side clinger on or whatever this guy was.
Well, Harold Hudson Channer, you know, the guy does the New York cable TV conversation with me?
Yeah.
He did an interview with Bucky Fuller in 1974. He's a big fan of Bucky Fuller, and he's played it several times over the past year, and I've watched it. And Bucky gets bogged down in having no clue about what's going on around him in McLuhan terms. And McLuhan called Bucky a 19th century man. So once you get over the general hypnosis and awe of Bucky Fuller, you think, yeah, he didn't have a clue what was going on around him, and he was dupable, and maybe LaRouche is right.
Mm.
But let's not get arguing. That's okay. Something to look into.
Right.
You know, we use the process of negation and
grounds for further investigation.
Yeah, food for thought, and grounds for further research. Okay, so let's do the next. This one is another long one, but these are good. It's LaRouche advocates being able to pay attention for a long stretch of time. So that's another reason why we have long quotes here. We're using the LaRouche method. We're not doing little short aphoristic statements like McLuhan's. We're saying stuff that requires literate left hemisphere attention, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so this one, this quote is from the same essay, page, which is the secrets known only to the inner elites, and this is pages 68 and 69 in the original. We just did page 59 from the same essay. Now we're going 10 pages later.
No. We're going up through page 66 here. We're starting with One Cannot Spin Out.
Right, and we go up to...
We go to page 66.
Oh, you're right. I missed that. Oh, I was going down to the next one. Okay, so we're just doing page 66. And then we'll do a quote from several pages after that. Okay, so let's go... if you look ahead, you see he's going to just try to define reason in italics, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we're
going
to go back to what the heck does he mean by reason? What are we working towards? Because it could be criticized. It's just a bunch of words so far. You know, Roche is complexifying normal disagreeing with the contemporary model of your society.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, so this is from, what's the, again?
The secrets known only to the inner elites.
Page 66. One cannot spin out concrete physics from a philosopher's chair. The relationship of philosophy to physics is, more narrowly, to discern which philosophical statements by physicists are intrinsically, methodologically absurd. On the positive side, given adequate knowledge of physics to date, philosophy shows us how to select the experimental conception which will be most fruitful in gaining the next step of progress and mastery of the principles appropriate to physics. That, in general, is all that philosophy can accomplish with respect to positive sciences. That is all, but that is indispensable to the progress of science. That is the means by which the approach selected by the creative scientist is properly determined, just the in italics indispensable matter of approach. The case of the electron paradox is apparently illustrative.
It's appropriately illustrative.
Mm-hmm. Appropriately illustrative.
Illustrative.
Confronted with a problem involving, quote, elementary particle experimentation, knowing that the electron doctrine of accredited physics is intrinsically absurd, is representative of that kind of philosophical knowledge which guides the experimenter to the most fruitful experimental hypothesis. That illustrates the method to be applied. That illustrates the method to be applied in a more generalized way to order the progress of science in general.
Now, before you continue, this is what's interesting. Here's LaRouche. Everybody accepts electrons. LaRouche does not accept the electron doctrine. Isn't that either wacky or he's really trying to provide an anti-environment to the conventional wisdom?
Yeah.
Okay, the next paragraph begins with the word reason italicized.
Mm-hmm. Reason, which is definable in a consistent way in principle over the ages, is thus a kind of, quote, constant. However, reason is not otherwise constant. Reason is not otherwise constant, not linearizable. As it assimilates to itself the fruits of its own accomplishments in mastering the lawful ordering of the universe, reason develops itself in its particular powers. In this process of self-development of reason, mediated through the practical scientific progress effected by efficient action of reason, reason parallels and intersects the fundamental, also self-developing, lawful ordering of the universe.
end of quote, end of paragraph. Now, you see, he's starting to say that reason is, like I said, not something that concrete. It's a process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I remember Bucky was into process. You know, he would tie a rope in a knot in a rope, and then he would slide the knot along the rope, and he'd say, you know, he would point out that the knot only exists as a process on the rope because it's,
yeah, he calls it the pattern.
Yeah.
Just a minute, the train plane going over.
It's called it pattern integrity.
Yeah, pattern integrity. In reading Fuller closely, there is, to me, conceptual alignments with LaRouche, similar.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be his degree from McLuhan's LaRouche as a 19th century guide. And so he and Bucky are a certain kind of 19th century thinking.
Yeah.
Okay, but now let's go into this. I'm going to read it again, but see you really get what he's saying. This first paragraph, he's saying the philosopher, what's the role of speculative, some guy sitting in a chair speculating and being a philosopher compared to a physicist in the lab? He said the philosopher is only useful, but it's an important use, in laying out the methodological approach or looking up the statements and what the statements imply approach-wise, right?
Uh-huh.
So let's look at if that's right. Here's what he says in the first paragraph. One cannot spin out concrete physics from a philosopher's chair. The relationship of philosophy to physics is, more narrowly, to discern which philosophical statements by physicists are intrinsically methodologically absurd. On the positive side, given adequate knowledge of physics to date, philosophy shows us how to select the experimental conception which will be most fruitful in gaining the next step of progress and mastery of the principles appropriate to physics. So he's talking about which hypothesis would lead to a crucial experiment.
Mm-hmm.
So the philosopher kind of argues with, or platonic-wise, negates or interrogates the general statements of the physicist about what he thinks he's going to do.
Mm-hmm.
That, in general, is all that philosophy can accomplish with respect to positive sciences. That is all, but that is indispensable to the progress of science. That is the means by which the approach selected by the creative scientist is properly determined. Just the approach, just the indispensable matter of approach. Then he's going to go into the idea of the electron, and it's a paradox.
Okay, so this this paragraph here, I'm confused, because at first I thought he was saying that the philosopher is more or less useless, theorizing stuff in his head. But then he's saying, no, he is indispensable to the progress of science. So which is it?
Well, he's the one who takes the statements. The statements aren't the experiment.
Mm-hmm.
But when the physicist or scientist presents his aim, the philosopher, who is assumed to be up to date on the language of the physicists at that point, can criticize or support or make sure the statements are founded on something that might lead to a breakthrough.
See, I think of the philosopher as the guy who works in the dimension of the humanities. I think of the theoretical physicist as being the guy that...
Right, because that's because you've got the conventional Aristotelian hokey image of physicists. The physicist that LaRouche is talking about is the enlightened engineer, which is not what you get when you think of Einstein or Oppenheimer or Heisenberg. Heisenberg's principles of uncertainty. Ernst Mach, LaRouche didn't like.
LaRouche didn't like Einstein?
Ernst Mach. And Einstein, he said, was only half good. Einstein was was doing okay at the beginning, but he got waylaid by oligarchical influences, especially at the Copenhagen conferences in the late 20s. Famous arguments between Gödel, Heisenberg, Schrödinger, Einstein, and you had the quantum mechanics guys came in, and Einstein didn't totally agree with that. And so Einstein got farmed off to Princeton, just sat around for 20 years. 33 to 55, 22 years. I think he died in 55. They said Einstein got waylaid.
Hmm.
That's what's interesting. You get this whole interesting critique, and it's done, you know, they try to spell out their argument. You know, read some of the books on these issues.
Because Einstein didn't want to probe quantum physics, or didn't believe in quantum physics?
No, just that he got bogged down. He just didn't have the really good way of being a physicist was squelched after Riemann, and the oligarchs made it really bad to have a decent thinker. The word transfinite we used earlier.
Yeah.
That comes from one last breakthrough. Cantor, his name was K-A-N-T-O-R, I think, or C-A-N-T-O-R. He was the last guy in the late 1900s, 1800s, 100 years ago. After that, Bertrand Russell and A.N. Whitehead ruined physics and dominated by Ernst Mach and other characters. And there's a whole war going on for the last 100 years. And LaRouche's documents that in his essays, and other people who write books for him.
Mm.
They take letters and papers and show the suppression by the oligarchs. And Einstein was a victim. It was an eventual casualty of that.
Mm.
And that whole history is pretty interesting.
Mm.
So isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Interesting. You got to read their stuff. I mean, New Dark Ages goes into it a bit. You know, Carol White's book.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so we're...
The relationship of philosophy to physics. Well, again, when I think of philosophy, I think of when I think of even Aristotle, or I mean, when I think of even Socrates or Plato, I don't think of the scientist. I think of the guy whose philosophy has more to do with the humanities. I don't think of philosophy as being...
Yeah, and that's due to the cultural effect in the 19th century of Aristotelian domination by British intelligence over knowledge. And the images you have of philosophers and scientists are conditioned and erroneous. Plato was a scientist. He's the one who did the geometry. Aristotle just a guy sitting around categorizing things.
Oh, yeah.
You know, distinguishing and naming all the little plants and forms that he discovered.
Right.
He's the librarian, and Plato's out there moving forward.
So in Plato, science and philosophy hadn't been split apart
yet. That's right, yeah. Yeah, he was the engineer, philosopher, politician. So that's what LaRouche models himself on, and he sees the theoretical physicist is a Aristotelian... ivory tower, irrelevant guy.
Uh-huh.
Now, they are important activities of the theoretician and the practical physicist and experimenter, but the images we have of them, LaRouche says, are dulling.
Was either Socrates or Plato religious, or did they have spiritual philosophies?
Mysticism, Neoplatonism is a kind of a Gnosticism or mysticism that people attribute to Plato, and it's called Neoplatonism. And some people say he's a mystic, but LaRouche wouldn't agree with that. And Socrates, I don't know what he was.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And Aristotle, I don't know what he was. I'm not familiar on the... It might have been, you know, some kind of religion of that period.
Right.
I'm not sure. I have to check that out. But whatever the categories are, I don't consider them important. It's their method, their approach, which LaRouche is emphasizing. Because if they are this or that, those are just mythologies of the times that LaRouche would say those guys weren't really fully identifying with.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
So let's move on. The case of the electron, they would just put on, well, they may not even put it on. You'd have to look it up. I mean, it's almost like Socrates made philosophy his religion.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you get the idea of a humanist.
Yeah, but did he believe in the world of the spirit? Well, there was
Plato,
archetypes.
Yeah, Plato apparently said, well, one, you know, Aristotelian, poor way of Plato would say he believed in mysticism, but LaRouche, I don't think, would totally agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
He wouldn't limit to those terms.
Well, you think of the story of Plato's cave where the guys are chained to the wall and they only see the shadows and they never turn around and see the light.
That becomes a mystical parable, and LaRouche says, well, that becomes distracting from the hard, dirtier hand work of making more technology and building up the population density.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's not like trying to make your screw like rabbits and have more people. You have to have the technologies to support more people. But the sign that you are progressing is that you are supporting more people, and they're relatively healthy and progressing and not hungry.
Yeah.
So but
does population density imply millions of more people spread out across the land, or millions more people living in a small area, and therefore, you know, within the pressures of everybody bumping everybody's elbows?
That's a conventional image under oligarch conditions. But LaRouche designed cities as healthier than that, and it wouldn't be that kind of situation.
Well, the thing is, imagine a planet that has 1 million people. Well, there's no population density if they're spread out all across the planet. The same planet with 1 million people, if they're all living in the space of 100 square miles, is got population density.
Yes, but you have the structures and habitats to make it comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in LaRouche's images for colonies on Mars or the Moon, he uses the Bucky Fuller Dome, or it seems to be dome-like, and he has these really neat modern, hyper-modern structures that people live in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it's ecologically pretty pleasant. He's not into having dirty cities.
Right. But you have to, if everybody's in, if you, you know, an ecological situation where people do live in close quarters, and there has to be a very efficient way in which people interact, engage, couple, link up, you know, with one another in order to make the thing function like an organism, you know, make the colony function like an organism.
You got a what?
Huh? Well, I'm just saying that you could have a very efficient, let's say you have a building that has, without technology, there's just too many people to live in that building. People will just be killing each other.
Yeah.
But with the right technology, the same number of people could live efficiently in that space, working together and creating, you know, and holistically, you know, working together like some big organism.
Right, that's what he's for, and he's not into moving to the cities, out of the cities into the country, and having, you know, rural, broken technology.
Mm-hmm.
Just because it ecologically seems to be ecologically saner.
Mm-hmm.
But you're looking at pollution, and you're running from it, but you're not looking at the oligarch system that creates the pollution.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't run from it, you get rid of the oligarchs and bring in better technology, which the oligarchs have not been promoting.
Right.
So he says the case of the electron paradox is appropriately illustrative. Confronted with a problem involving elementary particle experimentation, knowing that the electron doctrine of accredited physics is intrinsically absurd, is representative of that kind of philosophical knowledge which guides the experimenter to the most fruitful experimental hypotheses. In other words, the Platonic philosopher would point out that you're trying to do an elementary particle experiment, and it's based on the doctrine of electrons, then you're on the wrong track, buddy.
Well, the electron paradox has to do, I think it has to do with, you know, is it a wave or is it a bullet?
Yeah.
So is he saying that it's absurd to consider the electron paradox, or is he saying there's no such thing as electrons?
He's saying that getting bogged down with the argument of whether it's a wave or a
particle
is a distraction from developing valid experimental support for new technology.
Mm-hmm.
You don't sit around arguing whether it's a wave or a particle, and that concept may not lead to new technology. But you got supposedly 20th century science trying to create experiments to determine whether it's a wave or particle. And that would be an elementary particle experiment, and that's totally distracting.
Sure. Well, it probably leads to the kind of thinking that leads to quantum physics, or some understanding of the wacky laws of quantum physics.
Yeah, and that probably is. I haven't read LaRouche. He likes Gödel and Schrödinger, but he doesn't like a lot of the other guys. He doesn't like Heisenberg and another guy, I can't remember, is Pauli, P-A-U-L-I. He doesn't like those guys, and I have to get out the books and look at what part of quantum mechanics he supports and what he doesn't. He's probably irrelevant. He said to me in a dialogue that there are fad. Like, he doesn't think much of Stephen Hawking. He says Stephen Hawking just... he says there's always these fads every few years, every few decades, a new model like string theory or quantum mechanics or the black holes. He says this is all oligarchy crap and just models to entertain the uninformed and distracts people from the actual engineering work.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think he makes much of any of these models because there are universal principles that you're trying to unfold. And we'll be able to come back to this as he gives us more data.
Yeah.
But continuing here, the case of the electron paradox is appropriately illustrative. Confronted with a problem involving elementary particle experimentation, knowing that the electron doctrine of accredited physics is intrinsically absurd, is representative of that kind of philosophical knowledge which guides the experimenter to the most fruitful experimental hypotheses. In other words, guides them away from the electron problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
That illustrates the method to be applied in a more generalized way to order the progress of science in general. Now, some people say, well, it's pretty fascist. It's going to tell people how to do science, but... He thinks that the more you understand in the unfolding of reason, which he's going to explain in the next paragraph, you would go that way inevitably because that's the, quote, correct way. So what is reason? Reason, which is definable in a consistent way in principle over the ages, is thus a kind of constant. So it's a constant rather than speed of light. Reason is the constant. However, reason is not otherwise constant. It's not linearizable. It's not something you map out like a Euclidean... geometry proposition.
Mm-hmm.
Not an assumption.
Right.
As reason assimilates to itself the fruits of its own accomplishments, that means population density, in mastering the lawful ordering of the universe, in other words, there are laws in the universe, and as you master them or unfold them, discover them, reason develops itself in its particular powers.
Well, I just thought of something.
Can you hear that plane?
Yeah.